Thank you for joining us for the Monday, September 19th reading of the Greeley Tribune. My name is John Middleton. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Judicial experts critique lack of resources in family courts. Advocates allege women's accusations face disbelief. By Morgan McKenzie. Train hits Platteville police vehicle on tracks. Woman's hurt seriously. By Kara Nicholson. Missing hiker found dead in Horsetooth Mountain Park. By reporter Harold Staff. Windsor Good Samaritan Society plans 100 acts of kindness for 100-year anniversary. By Morgan McKenzie. Weld County Sheriff's Office seeks fatal hit-and-run suspect. By Morgan McKenzie. Followed by miscellaneous articles. Judicial experts critique lack of resources in family courts. Advocates allege women's accusations face disbelief. By Morgan McKenzie. Faced with financial struggles, doubt, and bias, a Greeley woman is fighting a difficult court battle to protect her young daughter from the man accused of sexually abusing her father. Her story is just one example of the complex nature of Colorado family courts that advocates, lawyers, and forensic experts are speaking out about. Many advocates argue victims, most commonly women, often face injustice when seeking its opposite amid child abuse and domestic violence allegations. Legal workers, meanwhile, find caseworkers, judges, forensic evaluators, therapists, and law enforcement officers lack essential training to make accurate determinations in family violence cases. Why this is happening? Mothers in domestic violence situations who report their child has been abused by the father typically face backlash and disbelief, according to Judy Beth Atwood, a domestic violence advocate for mothers in Colorado. Usually, Atwood said, the mistreatment of women by those involved in the investigation leads to a costly and unjust uphill court battle for victims like Greeley resident Michelle, whose last name is being withheld, to protect the identity of the child victim in this case. The mother becomes a lot of the time actually not believable and becomes the actual target of the investigation, Atwood said. So what's been happening is that mothers are disbelieved. It's been known throughout the United States that when these allegations are made, mothers lose custody. Nobody seems to really want to help with this horrible situation because a lot of the time it is the father who is abusing the child and the child is forced to live with her or his abuser. Attorney Jessica Peck's caseload involves 80% serious family violence or child abuse allegations. She represents accusers, the accused, and those accused of making false allegations. She said a lack of resources and forensic training lies at the heart of most issues within the family court system. Though victims and advocates believe the court has a systemic bias against women, Peck said the court system often gets it wrong due to the complexities of separating fact from fiction when it comes to family violence. In every case where there are child abuse allegations, there's almost always a response of parental alienation or false allegations, meaning if I accuse you of child abuse, your response, 9 times out of 10, is going to be you are lying and you are engaging in parental alienation, Beck said. Parental alienation happens when one parent intentionally displays to the child unjustified negativity that's aimed at the other parent. When this occurs, or there are fake allegations made, officials don't always have the resources to determine the truth, she said. A lack of resources leading to parental alienation is especially present in Weld County, according to Peck. In family courts, serious allegations can result in somebody losing custody entirely or partially without any serious vetting of those allegations, Peck said. Conversely, a parent who is falsely accused of making these allegations never gets vetted either. So that's the concern. When somebody makes an allegation, regardless of whether it's true or false, our family court system lacks sufficient resources to determine the truth in those situations, Peck said. Peck worked on a Weld County case involving a young girl who had bloody underwear. The police accused her mother of making false allegations, but the underwear was never tested before law enforcement came to that conclusion. My goal when I represent my clients is to get to the truth and to ensure that we have the least amount of false allegations made and that we have true allegations properly vetted to ensure that kids stay safe, Peck said. Unfortunately, in Weld County, there is a tremendous hole on limited resources. Discrediting Michelle and other mothers. Michelle said her ex, whose name is being withheld to protect the child victim, made threats to kill her after she asked him to leave their home upon discovering he partook in sexually demeaning activities, including hiring sex workers while they were together and watching child pornography. Throughout Colorado, Atwood vouched to hearing a considerable number of stories from women in situations similar to Michelle's. What's really concerning to me is I see posts from women in different counties that I don't know, I've never met, and I read their stories and it matches Michelle's, Atwood said. It's just sickening. Michelle needs to be heard. Michelle's case began after her ex's departure when their 3-year-old child, now age 4, made allegations of sexual abuse against him. Michelle took her daughter to a therapist, and the therapist indicated the child disclosed her father touched her inappropriately multiple times, and it made her feel sad. The therapist also documented that Michelle reported her child had since developed anxiety, had trouble sleeping, and faced regressions in milestones, including having more accidents despite being potty trained. Shortly after, the therapist made a report to Child Protective Services, or CPS, and the Greeley Police Department got involved. In late September, officers involved in the investigation documented the sexual abuse allegations made by the child, including claims that the accused would watch child pornography with his daughter in the room, according to the initial police record. After the interview, officers contacted CPS. A few weeks later, Michelle asked police officers to collect evidence after she found a shirt that was crumpled up on the sleeve. She told officers her daughter reacted to the shirt by crying, screaming, and throwing herself on the floor. The child indicated her father used the shirt to wipe off his genitals after a sexual act, according to the police report. The officers collected the item for evidence, but said there was not enough evidence to support a DNA analysis for the shirt. Meanwhile, investigators called him to request an interview. He denied the accusations and said he didn't know why his child made them. He also declined to meet with the officer. As a result, police declared there was not enough evidence. Throughout the investigation, Michelle made multiple attempts to prove her daughter's case by providing recordings of her daughter talking about the abuse, as well as the accused's handwritten diary sharing his involvement in sexually demeaning activities. Despite Michelle's efforts and evidence, an officer noted in a police report that she appeared to be bipolar in nature, and it was unknown if this is what is affecting her mental state in this case. I read the Greeley police reports, and they were completely biased against Michelle, Atwood said. They made accusations that her mental health was questionable. Michelle was traumatized, as any mother would be in this situation. Not only did she find out that the man that she was involved with had these horrible deep sexual deviant activities going on in her home, but he was exposing her child to those sexual deviant activities. CPS charges Michelle with child abuse. CPS cannot discuss particular cases due to confidentiality laws, but Jamie Ulrich, director of Weld County Department of Human Services, answered the Greeley Tribune's general questions about child abuse cases. If there is a suspicion of sexual abuse, the investigation is handled similarly to most reports of abuse, which includes assessing for safety and leaving the investigation to the police, according to Ulrich. Many sexual abuse cases also involve a child getting interviewed at Life Stories. CPS works closely with the detectives assigned to the case, as well as staff the case with the multidisciplinary team, Ulrich said. If the victim is a toddler, he said, the toddler may have difficulty reporting abuse or neglect based on their level of communication. If they were able to communicate to an adult who then reported for them, we would take the information seriously, as we do all reports, Ulrich said. CPS was involved in investigating the allegations Michelle made against her ex, including claims that she found out he watched child pornography and masturbated in spaces her children could have seen, such as the kitchen and his vehicle. In the father's interview with CPS, he admitted to the caseworkers that he had a porn addiction and watched with his daughter present while she was usually playing or sleeping, the CPS report said. In Colorado, the promotion of obscenity to a minor child is a Class 6 felony, carrying 1 year to 18 months in prison, as well as mandatory sex offender registration. Promotion entails producing, presenting, or directing an obscene performance to a minor. Since the caseworker found no evidence to suggest the 3-year-old watched porn with her dad, the assessment was declared unfounded. A CPS referral also conveyed that he masturbated while watching pornography with a child present, which he also admitted to, but he stated the child never watched it with him. However, the definition of sexual abuse includes indecent exposure, according to the Colorado Department of Human Services. Michelle's ex admitted to indecent exposure, exposing his genitals to another when a parent commits the act in front of a child, which the accused admitted to doing in this case, according to the report. It's considered sexual abuse. Despite the definition, the caseworkers closed the assessment due to a lack of evidence to support the allegations, according to the report. At the child's forensic interview at Life Stories, Michelle mentioned there were multiple incidences of her daughter being victimized by her father. She said her child indicated he touched her inappropriately on numerous occasions, but police stated in their report there was only one account made by the child. During the initial contact with the examiner, Michelle acted very irrational and was adamant her daughter was sexually assaulted, the report said. The examiner also wrote that when Michelle and the 3-year-old walked into the room, the child spontaneously utters that her dad touched her inappropriately. The interviewer asked how it made her feel, and she responded, sad. When the person conducting the interview left the room, the child began to cry. The examiner said she believed it was a fake cry, according to the report. The examiner went back into the room to check on the child, and she indicated the victim immediately stopped crying and changed her mood to happy. The interviewer, based on her training and experience, reported the child manipulated the situation to present as sad. Atwood said the forensic interview was considered a failure by CPS because they couldn't get disclosure from the child. Ulrich indicated CPS doesn't think any interviews with a child and an interview with a child is a failure. But when children give information that may not align with specific evidence or accounts of others, it is difficult to prosecute, she said. Michelle had doubts about the examination. She discovered the employee had only been working with CPS for 3 months prior to the interview. Atwood said CPS ended up charging Michelle with child abuse around the time she questioned the examiner's qualification based on a belief that Michelle put the words into her daughter's mouth. However, Atwood argued CPS had no proof or witnesses to their claims and believed the charges stemmed from retaliation. Ulrich said they assess for safety and determine a finding based on the preponderance of the evidence, so 51% is more likely than not that the abuse occurred. Additionally, parents telling their young children to make up stories of abuse against another parent happens in Weld County, or Ulrich said, most commonly in divorce situations. Issues with forensic training. If a child makes a serious allegation, whether it's family court, juvenile court, or criminal court, the system is supposed to forensically interview that child to determine if there was abuse, Peck said. But many interviews are problematic. One of the biggest issues Peck attested to seeing is a deficiency of forensic training for police officers and caseworkers, as well as family court allowing child hearsay to varying degrees. Although this isn't the case for every situation, CPS caseworkers lack experience, she said. When a CPS caseworker interviews a child, Peck often observes a lot of leading questions rather than open-ended questions. The interview is also frequently conducted with parents in the room. I see this all the time, actually, whether it's a law enforcement officer, a CPS caseworker, or a mental health professional, they will interview a child in front of the parent, Peck said. That should never happen. They will ask leading questions, and they don't bring in a professional who is sufficiently trained in asking questions in a way that produces the correct answers. In one case Peck worked on, a woman faced repeated accusations of making false child sex abuse allegations against her child's father. The dad accused the mother of punching the four-year-old in the face. The police officer in the case, lacking the necessary training, interviewed the child outside the police station with the father present. He asked, "Did your mother hit you?" instead of asking, "What happened?" As a result, Peck's client went several months without seeing her child outside of supervised visitation. To combat the issues with forensic training, Peck indicated a need for a person to supervise new caseworkers. Weaponizing counts. With CPS allegations against Michelle, the child's father filed for full custody of their child. Although a judge denied his request, the dispute placed the former couple in a family court case, something impossible to fight on her salary of $14.50 per hour. In testimony to the Colorado legislature, Brandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist and violence expert who has taught at Yale and Columbia, said family courts are ill-equipped when dealing with dangerous personality disorders, and judges often fall into the games perpetrators play and misunderstand how traumatized people respond to domestic violence and child abuse. A study commissioned by the U.S. Department of Justice in 2011 found that domestic violence is frequently undetected in custody cases or ignored as a significant factor in determination of custody and visitation. As a result, Lee said, the courts construct biases against women, children, and the allegations of abuse, and it helps dangerous people, particularly men, to weaponize the courts as an extension of their abuse. Lee shared that one example of this is parental alienation. The theory allows a parent, usually the father, to create a claim that that child's sexual, physical, and psychological abuse is rare and made up by the primary caregiver, usually the mother, to alienate the other parent. In those allegations, there is usually no vetting against someone, according to Peck, who also highlighted a tactic where a parent uses their child as a weapon in family court litigation to get back at the other person. It's prolific. The number of cases where children are weaponized in an improper way is stunning, Peck said. The vast majority of family law cases that involve children, people conduct themselves ethically, but unfortunately, there's still an outrageous number of cases where all that doesn't happen. When courts believe a father's claim of alienation, fathers win about 95% of the cases, regardless of whether or not the mother claimed abuse, according to a 2020 study by Joan Meyer. When alienation claims are believed and domestic violence has been claimed, fathers win 73% of the cases. When child abuse allegations are involved, the father wins 69% of cases. When child sexual abuse allegations are involved, 81% of cases are won by the father. Despite the high number of cases won by perpetrators who claim reports of abuse are false, mothers make false claims in less than 2% of custody disputes, a 2001 study by Nicholas Bala and colleagues found. Even in findings of false allegations, Peck rarely sees criminal charges brought against someone who is accused of falsely accusing another of serious crimes. The law enforcement and prosecutors do not want to draw conclusions about whether it's actually a false allegation beyond a reasonable doubt, Peck said, because that's the standard of criminal court. So if there was any shred of doubt that this allegation was false or that this allegation was legitimate, they will not charge in the vast majority of counties. Children, domestic violence victims at risk. Lee said in her speech that more than 58,000 children per year are ordered into unsupervised custody by their physical or sexual abuser following divorce in the United States. Meanwhile, the protective parent loses custody. In 2008, over 850 children involved in contested custody have been murdered, primarily by abusive fathers, according to the Center for Judicial Excellence findings. In Colorado, 17 children have died due to poor judicial decisions of placing youth back into the homes of their perpetrators, Atwood highlighted. It's killing our children, Atwood said. Our children are literally being state-ordered to go live with an abuser. A majority of contested custody cases are also domestic violence cases involving dangerous people, Lee said. In total, 75% of women killed by abusers are killed after they leave. Michelle can't protect herself. Parents often lack resources to fight their court battles, especially victims and those falsely accused. Michelle touched my heart in so many ways, Atwood said. I never met a victim like Michelle. She's got the world's biggest heart. She was just so willing to do the right thing, but she lacks income. She lacks the ability to protect herself. In family court, people don't have a right to an attorney or an investigator, resulting in one parent going up against the other parent, according to Peck. There are more people who are unrepresented, they don't have a lawyer, In family court than all other areas of the law combined, Peck said. For mothers like Michelle who make minimum wage, financial struggles set them up for failure in family courts, especially since they are forced into hiring lawyers and parent responsibility evaluators, or PREs, to protect their children and themselves. Most attorneys make $250 an hour, Matwood said. When you're a Michelle that makes $14.50 working full-time, how can you afford to pay an attorney that hourly rate? PREs are trained mental health professionals appointed to evaluate disputes about the allocation of parental duties for children. The PRE has the power to inform the court if he or she believes a mother made false allegations. In some cases, PREs can cost between $30,000 to $60,000, and there is no state funding for mental health professionals, Peck said. Many PREs are retiring due to recent changes in the law and COVID, worsening the lack of resources in family courts. In Colorado, Peck reported less than 10 PREs are serving the entire state. I see cases where a PRE absolutely understands and documents when there are false allegations or real allegations because PREs are mandatory reporters, Peck said. I think there are a lot of really fantastic PREs, but what is frustrating is that there is a lack of consistent training and knowledge when it comes to how to process serious allegations of abuse and serious allegations of false abuse. Fighting back calls for oversight. To battle the negative treatment of women in family courts, Atwood gathered a team of legal professionals to help Michelle put together an appeal to CPS. This poor woman had been re-victimized so many times, and it's just unbelievable, Atwood said. I could see her case going in such a bad direction, and that's why I stepped in. I said, hey, Michelle, like, I know lots of women like you, and I think I can help you. The appeals process goes through the Attorney General's chief deputy, who Atwood said has access to the CPS records that contain the accused's admissions and watching porn around his daughter. Also, Chelsea Angeli from Wells Family Law in Denver took on Michelle's case pro bono, Atwood said. But to see real change within the court systems, a nationwide effort of judicial oversight through transparency, journalistic reporting, and survey documentation is necessary every time a litigant appears before a judge, according to Lee's testimony. She said judges are never held responsible for their decisions due to immunity, which is something Lee feels should not be allowed when there is corruption, criminality, and fraud. Peck clarified family court proceedings are open in Colorado, but juvenile court proceedings are protected. Over the past several years, family courts have been strict about whether they approve a request to suppress a case file, PRE reports, on the other hand, are confidential. It's just crazy two-tiered system that really ought to be brought under one standard, Peck said about the family and juvenile courts. That's part of the reason we see different levels of transparency between the two court systems. In addition, Lee requested in her testimony that judges and court personnel must be held accountable when their rulings lead to the death of a child or child abuse. A system of impunity, abuse of power, and self-imposed secrecy have proven not to work, Lee said. Through Atwood's experience and work in domestic violence, she said the state always makes mothers pay the price. When a mother loses custody of her child, she has to write a complaint to the Judicial Disciplinary Committee, which can take up to 8 months to be addressed, Atwood said, as an example. She believes the establishment of an organization or ombudsman that investigates these cases and holds judges accountable, paid for by the state, is required. There are some resources offered in Colorado that provide these types of services to children and families, including Colorado's Child Protection Ombudsman. The agency serves all 64 counties independently from the state and county agencies that work on behalf of children and families by listening to public concerns about child protection and investigating claims. Since its formation in 2010, the office has received more than 3,900 calls, up to 7 calls per day, from Colorado residents seeking help, according to their website. "It shouldn't be on the mother," Atwood said. "A mother is simply protecting the child. We need an investigation here. We need to find out why all these cases sound alike. What is going on?" Train hits Platteville police vehicle on tracks. Woman hurt seriously. The injured 20-year-old woman was taken to a Greeley hospital with serious injuries. By Kira Nicholson. A woman in police custody was seriously injured Friday night when the patrol vehicle she was placed in, which was parked on railroad tracks, was hit by a train. The incident happened about 7:30 p.m. near U.S. 85 and Weld County Road 38, just north of Platteville, according to a Colorado Bureau of Investigation news release. Police were responding to an initial report of road rage involving a firearm in Fort Lupton when the train collision incident unfolded, the Bureau said. The officer located a vehicle and made a traffic stop with a driver, a 20-year-old Greeley woman, of the vehicle pulling over just beyond the railroad tracks, according to the Bureau. The officer stopped on the railroad tracks behind the pulled-over vehicle. Two Fort Lupton officers arrived, and the woman, a felony menacing suspect, was removed from her vehicle and placed in the Platteville patrol car parked on the tracks. While the officers cleared the suspect's vehicle as part of the investigation, a train traveling northbound struck the PPD patrol car, the release said. The woman was taken to a Greeley hospital after the crash. Details on her injuries were not released. Fort Lupton police are investigating details that led to the initial call for police assistance. The State Patrol is investigating the woman's injuries, and the Colorado Bureau of Investigation has been asked to investigate the woman's injuries. Missing hiker found dead in Horsetooth Mountain Park, by the Reporter Herald staff. A man reported missing in Horsetooth Mountain Park on Saturday evening was found dead shortly after noon Sunday. The Larimer County Sheriff's Office said the man was reported missing at about 6:45 p.m. Saturday after a group of hikers became lost and separated from each other. According to a news release, emergency services personnel, deputies, rangers from Larimer County Department of Natural Resources, members of Larimer County Search and Rescue, Poudre Fire Authority, and UC Health medical crews searched the area until after midnight, when the search was put on hold until daylight. They started searching again around 7 a.m. Sunday, and at about 12:25 p.m., the man was located beneath a rock ledge. His body was recovered, and the incident is being investigated as an unattended death, according to the release. The man's identity and his cause of death and manner of death will be released by the Larimer County Coroner's Office. Windsor Good Samaritan Society plans 100 acts of kindness for 100-year anniversary. By Morgan McKenzie. Good Samaritan Society Water Valley in Windsor is celebrating 100 years of the Evangelical Lutheran Good Samaritan Society. To commemorate the milestone of serving communities for 100 years, employees and residents of Good Samaritan Society Water Valley are participating in 100 acts of kindness, collecting 100 cans of food for the Windsor Food Bank and taking 100 steps with a staff member, according to a Sanford Health release news release. The celebration taking place on September 29th, and the organization's anniversary, will also include a parade, ice cream social, and live music. This is an exciting time for the Good Samaritan Society, activities coordinator Jennifer Alexander said. It's an honor to be part of the Windsor community. We are so grateful to our residents and families and proud of our employees for their relentless commitment to caring for our residents. The Evangelical Lutheran Good Samaritan Society, rooted in faith, compassion, and community with residents, families, and employees at the heart of the organization, all started with one man in Arthur, North Dakota, the release said. Reverend August Dad Hauger had a passion for healing through ministry and compassionate quality care, which turned into a vision to serve a vulnerable population, seniors. His vision led to offering seniors and others in need a place to receive focused, skilled care with an additional priority on nurturing their spiritual health, according to the release. Since its establishment in 1922, the Evangelical Lutheran Good Samaritan Society has provided senior care and services to more than 200 locations across the United States, including Good Samaritan Society Water Valley. Looking back at the last century also builds hope for the Good Samaritan Society's future, including continuing to integrate and innovate with Sanford Health, where the individual organization's unique strengths make them stronger together and can help the Good Samaritan Society invest in a bright, long future of serving those in need, Alexander said. Weld County Sheriff's Office seeks fatal hit-and-run suspect by Morgan McKenzie. The Weld County Sheriff's Office is searching for a driver involved in a fatal hit-and-run crash Sunday evening just north of Greeley. Around 5:30 p.m., a white van and a motorcycle collided near AA Street and 37th Avenue, according to a Sheriff's Office news release. As deputies were responding to the crash, the driver ran from the scene into a nearby cornfield. The driver is described as a slightly heavyset Latino man in his 40s, standing about 5 feet 7 inches tall, the release said. He was last seen wearing a dark blue shirt, blue jeans, and white tennis shoes. Weld deputies, Colorado State Patrol troopers, and officers from local agencies are actively looking for the driver of the van. If anyone has information, the sheriff's office advises people to call 911 immediately. Those with information regarding this or any other crime are asked to call the Weld Sheriff's Office at 970-356-4015 or Northern Colorado Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8477. People can also submit tips online at www.crimeshurt.com. Submitters may become eligible for a cash reward if a tip through Crime Stoppers leads to the arrest and filing of charges on a suspect. Boy 10 dies after he was hit by a car while riding a scooter in Arvada. By Shelley Bradbury of the Denver Post. A 10-year-old boy died Sunday after he was hit by a car while riding an electric scooter in Arvada, police said. A driver hit the boy with a vehicle around 7:40 p.m. Saturday in the 9800 block of Candelas Parkway as the child was riding an electric scooter, Arvada police said. He died from his injuries early Sunday morning. The driver of the vehicle stayed at the scene and cooperated with police, Detective David Snelling said. No charges have been filed and the driver has not been arrested, he said. The Arvada Police Department crash team is investigating the crash to determine if any charges are applicable, the police said in a statement. Snelling did not know who the boy was with when the crash happened. An opinion piece by Joe Barrera, written for the Gazette. The Meaning of Hispanic Heritage Month. Some friends asked me why Chicanos, Latinos, need to celebrate the September 15th, October 15th Hispanic Heritage Month. Aren't you Americans now, they ask? I answered, actually, we all should celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month because this is an American celebration, especially when we celebrate what are called Fiestas Patrias, or patriotic holidays, because that means that we honor two patrias, two countries, usually understood in the U.S. to mean the United States and Mexico. In Mexico, the Fiestas Patrias tradition celebrates five patriotic holidays, March 21st, the birthday of Benito Juarez, the Zapotec Indian, who is Mexico's greatest president, May 1st, or May Day, which is the Labor Day in Mexico. May 5th, El Cinco de Mayo, the anniversary of the Battle of Puebla, in which the Mexicans defeated an army of French invaders. September 15 through 16, El Grito de Dolores, literally the cry of pain or sorrows, which was the rallying cry of the 1810 Mexican War of Independence against Spain, and November 20th, the day that Francisco Madero became the Revolution of 1910, began the Revolution of 1910 against the dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz, who had ruled Mexico with an iron fist for 31 years. These holidays teach us to recognize that Mexico has had a very painful history, that it is still a country facing many challenges, like many other Latin countries, but growing into a modern, stable democracy. In this country, Hispanic Heritage Month recognizes the Mexican traditions, but because millions of Chicanos and other Hispanic people from all over the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean are now proud Americans, Hispanic Heritage Month is an all-inclusive commemoration. This means that we celebrate not only the unique mixture of our Spanish, Native American, and Afro-Caribbean heritages and the resulting diversity of many cultures, there is no such thing as one Latino culture, but that we also aim to celebrate what we have become as Americans living in the second largest Hispanic country in the world. There are 60 million Latinos in the U.S. We are the largest group of people of color, a designation that has to be qualified because, in appearance, we range from black to brown to cafe au lait to blonde and blue-eyed. This reflection is a reflection of the amalgamation of the many gene pools in Mexico, Latin America, and the Caribbean. It is a lesson that we can teach, a lesson in human bonding that the United States should take to heart. This is the best reason for Hispanic Heritage Month in the U.S. During this special time of Hispanic Heritage Month and every day of the year, what do we want to tell our fellow citizens? That we have found our home in the United States, that we are proud to be Americans, that the majority of us are U.S. citizens, that most of us speak only English, and rapidly becoming mainstreamed, that millions of us are not immigrants because we are descended from ancestors who were in the Southwest long before the arrival of Anglo-Americans. that we didn't come to the United States came to us, because the U.S. invaded Mexico in 1846 to 48 and wrenched away half of Mexico's national territory, what are now the states of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Nevada, Utah, and parts of Colorado. That makes us American, even if America many times discriminates unfairly against us. But no matter, we are still very much in love with the USA. What kind of love is this? In Washington, D.C., there is a monument that tells a story by the names carved into it. It is the Wall, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. When you stand in front of that black polished granite, you see the names of soldiers who died for their country. There are thousands of Spanish surnames. On no other public monument are we recognized like we are on the Wall. We earned that inclusion on the roll call of honor because we paid for it in blood. Joe Barrera, Ph.D., is the former director of the Ethnic Studies Program at UCCS, that's the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. He teaches Mexico, U.S. border studies, and U.S. military history. He is a combat veteran of the Vietnam War. Plane collision. Three dead after two planes collide, by Dana Cady for the camera. Three people are dead after two planes collided in midair Sunday morning south of Longmont in Boulder County. Mountain View Fire Rescue responded to reports of a plane crash around 9 a.m. in the area of North 95th Street and Niwot Road. Upon arriving, the first responders found two crash sites. The planes were small, single-engined aircraft, capable of holding around four passengers, and were most likely non-commercial craft, said Mountain View Fire Rescue Fire Chief Dave Beebe. The first aircraft was found on the south side of Niwot Road, about a mile east of 95th Street. There were two confirmed occupants in the aircraft, both of whom were dead when first responders arrived on the scene, according to a news release from the Boulder County Sheriff's Office on Saturday morning. The second plane was found on the north side of Niwot Road, about half a mile east of 95th Street. First responders confirmed one occupant in the aircraft who was dead upon their arrival on the scene, according to the release. The decedents have not been identified at this time, Beebe said. Mountain View Fire Rescue did not know which airport, if any, the planes took off from Saturday morning, Beebe said. Beebe said that if the collision had happened a month ago, there might have been a fire, but the moist vegetation in the area helped prevent this from happening at the crash site. Cindy Walcott, who lives across the street from the site where the second plane crashed, said she heard a loud popping sound around 9 a.m., followed by another loud crash. She said the popping sound was most likely made by the planes colliding and that the crash was the sound of the second aircraft landing near her home. It was obviously a plane crash, Walcott said. Carrie Hayes, who lives across the street from the second crash site, heard the loud popping sound Saturday morning as well. He said he has observed these small plane crashes happening often in Boulder County. It seems like they're pretty frequent these days, Hayes said. The investigation is still in progress and is being led by the Boulder County Sheriff's Office. Niwot Road is closed to traffic between 95th and US 287. The public is asked to avoid the area as this is an ongoing investigation. Obituaries. An obituary for Mary Edith King. Mary Edith King, 84, of Greeley, passed on September 12th. She was born on April 22nd, 1938, in Denver, Colorado, to Frederick Harold Linebach and Alice Virginia Curry Linebach. She married Gary Dean King on June 11th, 1960, in Buffalo, Minnesota. She attended high school in Buffalo, Minnesota, and graduated from South Dakota State University. During college, Mary Edith worked at Palmer Gulch Lodge in the Black Hills of South Dakota, where she met Gary. Mary Edith spent her professional life devoted to educating children. She taught middle school home economics, substituted for several years, and completed her career as an elementary school teacher. Many students were also blessed to have Mary Edith as a tutor. She was a member of the First Congregational Church in Greeley for approximately 15 years, where she was also a proud member of the Women's Ruth Group. Mary Edith was a 4-H leader for over 10 years and volunteered for the Guadalupe Homeless Shelter by making meals and supporting their thrift store. In her later years, she loved regularly watching football, basketball, baseball, tennis, and golf on TV. Mary Edith enjoyed cross-stitching, quilting, sewing, baking, and gardening. She also loved spending time with her grandchildren and almost equally as much time with her pugs. She is survived by her son, Shannon King, and wife, Chris, daughters, Malena Dorchek and husband Anthony, and Mandy Hyduck and husband David, and a brother, Harold Leinbach. She is also survived by 5 grandchildren and many nieces and nephews. Mary Edith is preceded in death by her husband, Gary Dean King, parents Frederick Harold Leinbach and Alice Virginia Leinbach, and brother Paul Leinbach. Services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, September 19th. At the First Congregational Church, Greeley, with private family interment at Lynn Grove Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made to the First Congregational Church in care of Allnut Funeral Service, 6521 West 20th Street, Greeley, 80634. Friends may view the online obituary, sign the guest book, and send condolences at www.allnutgreeley.com. Obituary for Elsie Markley. Elsie Markley, Elsie M. Holman Markley, was born on February 2, 1931, in Ord, Nebraska, to Leo and Lucille Stone Holman. She passed away on September 7th in Fort Collins. Elsie married Edward T. Markley on November 8, 1949. She was preceded in death by her husband, Ed, son Rodney, 3 sisters, and 1 brother, and her parents. She is survived by 4 children, Ed, Roger, Vicky, and Bill, 8 grandchildren, and 15 great-grandchildren. Graveside service was held at 10 a.m. Thursday, September 15th, at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Friends may leave condolences at AdamsonCares.com. Thank you for joining us for the Greeley Tribune. My name is John Middleton.